You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting to Yes And.
If you want to come see us talk live on the Getting to Yes And podcast, well, I'm going to be talking to Keegan-Michael Key, Second City alum, and L. Key about their new book, The History of Sketch Comedy, A Journey Through the Art and Craft of Humor, on October 5th at 7 p.m. at the Francis Parker School. This is part of the Chicago Humanities Festival. If you want to get tickets, go to chicagohumanities.org. Today's guest is my old friend Mike Lucas, who has worked as an international touring stand-up comedian, appearing on The Tonight Show, Late Night with Conan O'Brien, the Just for Laughs Festival, and Aspen Comedy Festivals. He was the host and co-writer of The Straight Dope on A&E. He also trained at the Second City and was an original cast member for Second City's run at the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas, and we have some fun stories about that. He's got a great new book. It's called Finding Your Funny Muscle, How to Create Laughs Like a Pro. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Mike Lucas, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Kelly. It's been a while since we've talked, and I'm looking forward to it.
It has been a while.
Too long!
So,
right, isn't that what you have to say? It's been too long. Maybe it's been just right. Maybe that's, you know, maybe this is the perfect timing for this. We should not question.
Well, we're in our Lord's year of 2023.
That's
and
right.
I'm imagining we met in the late 90s.
I believe it was the mid 90s, because that was right when I started the program.
So 90, I love what you call the program.
I began the program.
Which it kind of is.
Well, and it was for me, because I was a stand-up and I was going into the improv world, and I had to almost deprogram from being a comedian who was looking for laughs and begin to be a listener.
Is this 95, 96, like in there?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah, it was right then. Well, I'd moved to Chicago. I mean, I grew up going to Second City, so I was a fan from birth. You know, my uncle lives there, my dad grew up there, and so he would take me to those shows. So I saw all the early 90s.
What a time
shows.
To walk into Second City.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I got to see like Colbert and that
Carell.
Yep. And then I got to watch all of those people kind of rise up and then go to the bigger screens. And it just, you know, I just wanted to do it ever since I was a kid. But stand up came first. And then I was like,
Well, frame of reference too, what people might not know is, like, in the 1980s, when you and I were sort of babies and coming up and trying to figure out what we were doing, and I wanted to be a playwright, you wanted to be a stand up. But the odds, I mean, the one thing I wanted to be a playwright for is I knew David Mamet was a dishwasher at Second City, and I became a dishwasher at Second City. So I'm like, I'm right. I can write those. But what people might not know is the boom in stand-up in the 80s was nuts.
It was nuts. Yeah, and everybody who had any jokes could get a gig, and that ended up backfiring eventually. But,
it did.
But at the time, it was seen as like this gold mine.
Clubs all over Chicago.
Yeah, people, and not just clubs, it was also one-nighters would open up.
Yes,
so
right.
You've got these weekend clubs that are owned by a booker, and then these weeknight one-nighters scattered around the city, and then they would basically pay for the weekend comics so that these bookers are, you know, getting free comedy in their own club. And it was a real cool racket, I guess, if you're on that side of the equation. And for us, it was stage time.
Do you remember when Matt Dwyer, who was an alum of Second City, started Midnight Bible School here?
Oh yeah. I think I did a couple sets in that one. That's
unbelievable lineups. I mean, if you remember, like, Zach was here.
Yeah.
Sarah.
Tina was, I think, did some sets.
Tina Fey did
some sets. That was what I liked about that show was the audience. Boy, like they wanted clever, but they also wanted, unique.
Yeah.
And that you really had to understand your own voice if you wanted to be successful in that crowd, because these were very intelligent and hip comedians who were also in the business. So, boy, it's like any of those industry shows, it kind of became one of those.
It was very much looking at what the future of that art form might be, and in what was a traditionally sort of hostile relationship, stand up and improv, yeah, attempting to bridge that.
I loved that because I was always trying to do that as well. And yeah, that show definitely did that. And it forced us comedians to look at our craft a little bit differently, because the audience was as a trained improvisation and sketch audience, and they responded things differently than a stand-up audience does. They're usually much more sober, on average, but I remember I produced a show at Zany's trying to do the same thing called The Riff. Actually, by then we called it Chicago Riffs, and it was a second sort of coming of this show, and we were doing sort of a long form improv meets stand-up monologue thing. So what the game of the show was, we had our house improv group was Amy Poehler and Matt Besser, and their whole
the Upright Citizens Brigade
before they went to New York. So mm-hmm, we got them the month before they stopped doing our show because they moved to New York. Like, that's how that timing was. And so they would basically be our improv troupe, and stand-ups would go up and tell the story. You weren't allowed to do your bits. You had to tell a story. But because we're comedians, the story would come out funny.
It's funny.
And then, the UCB would just go out there and crush, and do their scene work based on those suggestions. And it was a lot of fun. But again, they moved, so it was like, well, there goes the show.
Yeah. All right. I actually have a first question for you, and I blew it off in terms of our familiarity because we know each other. But I want to ask it to you because I thought about this.
Oh, yeah.
And what I tried to do with the podcast, and a lot of times I'm interviewing academics and other folks, and so I have to make this sort of justification for why they might be wanting to talk to me. And of course, this book is very clear in terms of why we might have a conversation. However, yesterday I interviewed Jeff Sweet, who is just releasing a revised version of his book, Something Wonderful Right Away, which is an oral history of the Second City that was originally published in 1978. And one of the themes I took away from the book is that the more things change, the more they stay the same at a place like Second City. But I also sense that's true in comedy as well. So styles, manner, tone, all of that changes. But at its essence, this work is about finding the truths in what it means to be a human being. Mm. Does that track for you?
That does. Yeah. And the thing about stand-ups is, like, the more the better you get at doing the craft, the more you consider what you just said. And in the beginning, you really are, you're like an infant thrown into a deep end of a pool, and you're just trying to like fight for breath and like get laughs. And you're just, you don't even know how to hold a microphone yet. So you're just doing things where you're just, you're just trying to please this crowd of people who don't know you. And, that's the hardest jump, is to go from making your friends and family laugh to strangers who are paying money. And it's just a big difference. And then as you begin to get more sophisticated as a joke deliverer, my whole thing, I say you have to go from being a corner quipper, somebody who just whips out jokes from any point of view, to being someone who has a comedy lens, somebody who understands the portal through which they look at life based on who they are and the struggles that they have and the things that come up in their life that make them want to make jokes. And then when you begin to have that lens, your comedy begins to be not only funnier, but more relatable and more memorable. And that's the key with what you're talking about, is the things that never change, but stay the same, is people love stories. And when you can tell your story about your quirky angle, and every good comic has a lens like that, then you begin to be more memorable and more relatable. And so your humor suddenly becomes, instead of a guy who at the office at the coffee machine who's cracking wise about the president, it becomes about a friend who's telling you a story that's personal and is having laughs with it. And then that is way more connecting than any just joke. And that's what I found. That's why I wrote the book I wrote, is because I didn't have a comedy lens that was very clear or very effective when I was trying to make it big, you know, when I had some big audiences in front of me. And that was my downfall, or the, at least the ceiling that I hit, was, who is this guy and why should we care? He's funny. He certainly is funny, but I don't like why is he funny? Where is he coming from? You know, I had my style down, but I didn't have my lens down. And so now I you know, with a lot of introspection, I realize I'm the clumsy Aspiehole. Mm-hmm. And I identify on the Asperger spectrum, and I'm this guy who my biggest laughs come from mocking my inability to physically and emotionally live up to the standard which I hold the world. I you know, like us Aspieholes are, you know, we notice and notify, we interject and correct, but yet we're always at fault for the very things that we blame the world on. And so that I found out that that's where my humor comes from. And organically, some of my bits that did really well in the old days have that lens, but now I can do it purposefully, and I can begin to exercise it like a muscle, as I say.
So everything you're saying is, of course, true for a comedian. I would suggest it is true for anyone who is trying to be self-actualized as a human.
But that's what I've been realizing with this book, Kelly. It's fantastic. Yeah. People have been coming up to me. I had one woman who was in her 70s, and she was like, you know, I read your book, and I never thought about this, but I think I'm kind of that person. My lens would be like, I get real excited about things and I jump aboard. And then I realize, oh boy, I'm not prepared to do any of the things I thought I was going to do. And then I have to either let someone down, or I have to admit it and go ahead and do it, but reluctantly. And she was like, I talked to a few of my friends and ran that lens by them. They were laughing and they said, yes. And so here's a woman who lived 70 years and never thought about this stuff. And suddenly she's examining her own lens, her own persona, her own, like what I say, the things that make you interesting to strangers that you might want to mention in a crowded elevator.
Right. And it's interesting, the work that we've done with the behavioral science community, one of the things that an early study that we drew on was from our friend Nick Epley, was that human beings are kind of reluctant to share personal details because they think other people aren't interested.
Right.
And what you know, and I know in terms of our expertise in comedy, is like, oh, no. They love that.
That's all we want to hear.
There's a reason Seinfeld was so popular, which is show about nothing. It's about everything.
Yeah. His lens to make a big deal out of nothing is brilliant because, you know, but that's a reflection of his personality. Like the culture he grew up in and the way he looked at life, he was literally bothered by the fact that things are brushed over, and he began to just stop and go, wait a minute, we're running right past these things that are so basic. And then you begin to, you know, you name it and claim it, whatever that basic thing is, you give it a name and you keep repeating it. And all of a sudden now everybody's laughing at it, you know?
So I want you to tell a couple stories that exist in the book. So one of the things, and I actually didn't know this about you, that you were in a frat. I did know that, but you were assigned a kind of a frat mentor.
Yeah, a big brother. They give you a big brother when you first come in.
Talk about this guy.
This guy, his nickname was Flammer. Basically because that was his last name first, you know, I didn't know this. I just thought, like, for whatever reason, I thought he
Flammer.
At one point flammed something. So he became Flammer, you know, one who flams, but that turns out to be his last name. And so Flammer, the story I tell in the book is he had us over his, when you're pledging a fraternity, you're basically slaves to these guys, the older brothers, and then they sort of put you through the ringer until you prove that you want to be part of this group. And I'm over at his house cleaning up. And so he calls me over we smoke up and he has me chug a beer. Mm-hmm. And at first I'm thinking he's going to haze me more, but no, he's like, he's getting me a little bit juiced. And then he says he wants to tell me the meaning of life. So I'm like, I'm prepared to hear something really, really big and important. And, he kind of draws it out. And so I'm, you know, more weed, more drinks. And so he finally lays it on me. He says, Mike, you're going to find that life, there are fun guys and there are fun guy. And I was like, okay. And I had no clue what he was talking about. I just knew that, you know, it was a play on words.
You couldn't Google it.
I couldn't Google it at the time. Yeah, this was last century, before Google was even invented.
There was no Google.
There was no clue. And so I had no clue. And I have a better idea of what he meant now. I mean, now that I had some retrospect. But at the time, I had no clue what he was talking about. And then in the book, what the point I make is that I realized it wasn't the meaning of life that he gave me. It was the meaning of comedy, how comedy works. Because what comedy does, the best jokes, what they do is they set up an expectation of normalcy. And it gets your brain thinking in a certain way. And then with that same setup, what they do is they deliver a surprise, something that you don't expect, but still fits in. It still satisfies that setup. And when you laugh is when you get that thing that they just told you that you wouldn't have thought of still satisfies that setup. You get that those two are still the same. So in his case, he was doing a sort of a play on words. And so, the payoff isn't that big. I say in the book, wordplay typically ends up at the groaner table, but a good pun, like there's a
pun, good pun can be solid. Sure.
They're very solid. Yeah. And they tend to make more intellectual people laugh because there's that connection. There's a real high level, world connecting going on there that doesn't occur to you that people are pleased by, if someone else comes up with it. So what I began to realize was that, when you want to begin to make people laugh, you have to first set them up to think of the most normal thing that this premise would lead to. And then you have to begin to get really good at giving them something different that still satisfies that setup. And in my book, what I do is I give you 36 humor heightening devices that allow you to do that. And so that's a real, mechanical way to practice, like as if you're practicing playing a guitar or a trumpet or a tennis racket. You're really finding out how is a laugh. I call it flexed, because I say it's funny, it's not a bone, but bones are stiff and rigid and they break. Funny is flexible and grows with use like a muscle. And so that's where I came up with the funny muscle idea. And these humor heightening devices, and from improv, heightening is the key to getting laughs. It's a yes anding and exploring a thing to a higher level that doesn't occur to you. And these heightening devices that I have allow you to do that and practice that mechanically until you can get it right and it drop to your muscle memory.
It's interesting too, because this is such a clear concept inside, especially joke telling. And one of the things that in the conversation with Jeff, so the first time around when he wrote the book, he had done this interview with Viola Spolin, the mother of improvisation, and she refused to have it included.
What?
So yeah, she wouldn't let it because she was tired of people making money off her. And he's like, "Look, it's a book. I'm making no money.
I'm not making anything."
So
I make a nickel a book, lady.
Yeah. So the estate said yes this time. And one of the lines that she says is she's asking her son, Paul Sills, what improvisation is. And she's like, "Look, I understand ad-libbing. And I know a lot of people who say they're doing improvisation are actually ad-libbing. What is improvisation?" And Paul doesn't know. But what they sort of agree on is that at its heart, it ends up being transformation. Right. And I think that is the difference when you turn joke telling, pure comedy, into a theatrical experience, into a narrative format, let's just say that, which is, and it doesn't have to, like there's plenty of stuff that lives on that surface, and that's fine for certain people. But for those of us who want to go the next step deeper, it's like, well, I kind of want to know more about the human condition. And you're going to get that when you get the transformation. And then that's the sort of like, I see myself in this. Oh no, I see myself in this.
And that's the beauty of that comedy lens that I preach is you really, when you have a clear comedy lens, all of your material becomes to the audience very clear in terms of that lens. You begin to see, oh, I get where they're coming from. And typically either you come from the same place because you're a fan of that person, or you know somebody, if you're new to this comic, you're like, oh my God, that reminds me of this person. So then that connection allows for more laughter because there's more relatability to it. And I think that's key. And when you're talking about a transformation, when you're a headliner, that's the difference between being an opener and a middle and a headliner. It's the level to which you are committed to that transformation for your crowd. And an opener is, like I said, you're literally just trying to survive out there. You're trying to get laughs. You're trying to figure out who you are on stage. The middle act is beginning to understand that a transformation needs to take place. I need to begin to bring these people in on a certain place, and then they need to leave at another place, having known who I am and why I think the world is funny and why my struggle are hilarious, or at least the way I face them. And then, but you're not quite under, as a middle act, clear on that. Whereas a headliner, that's you're booking somebody who is very clear on that story. And that's what it is. If you really want to get down to the nuts and bolts of it, it's a story. And people have longed to hear stories since the dawn of time. It's like, how can I vicariously live some struggles and watch you either fight them and survive or fight them and fail? But I don't have to go through it personally, but I get to vicariously feel it through you. And the best comedians and certainly the best improvisers provide that for their crowds.
So you were a founding member of Second City Las Vegas.
That is, yep. Yes. Yes. Oh, I was so proud of that. I got to tell you. I have a couple
things I want to talk to you about that experience. Yeah, that was a wild one.
The main claim, disclaimer, right? I'm kind of on a main stage, right? Right.
It was a resident stage.
Right, for sure.
You're on the alumni list. Where was Carrot Top in our world at that point?
Well, he's always been a friend of mine. His name's Scott Thompson, and I have been a big fan of him. He's one of those people that had such a clear comedy lens. This is a side note. You can use this or not, but I was in a workshop in Florida, and Scott Thompson walks in, and he says his name is Carrot Top. He's probably maybe 17 at the time. And so he comes in, and he's like, I want to try my stuff out. And the woman who runs the workshop is like, okay. Vicky Rousman. Vicky. Yeah. And Vicky can't stand prop acts. She's just like, she just hates them. And she hates all like gimmicky stuff.
Sure.
She's trying to help us find like a real true stand-up persona. So poor Scott comes in, and you know, I mean, you've been to these workshops, they suck. I mean, you try to be funny at them and people are staring at you. And if you can get them to laugh, it's like getting Lorne Michaels to laugh at your audition for SNL. It's almost impossible. But if it happens, you're just like a miracle. Well, Scott goes in there, Carrot Top starts doing his props, and he has us rolling, and we're just laughing and dying, and we're like, oh my God, this guy is a headliner. He knows what he's doing. He's just got material. So then there's a, you know, applause break. We almost give him a standing O. And so he's like out of breath at the end of it. And he's holding like six of his props still. And so it's like, you know, Vicky, well, what do you think? And she's like, oh, wow, you did really well. She's like, my suggestion, I would lose the props. That was her, like, that was the big takeaway. And we all were like, what? And it was like,
I get it.
Right. But yeah, be more observational. Just be the redheaded guy who
no, he's defied all odds with the props, let's be honest.
Right. And Scott, like, that was his main thing. He'd been doing that since he'd been a kid. Like, that he was born and raised to do that sort of the next Gallagher kind of a thing. And so
and he's actually calling back to a certain kind of vaudeville act.
I think
also something that, unless you understand the sort of historical precedent of this work, you don't get that feeds a certain kind of, and what we call it in terms of Second City shows is when someone does a skill piece.
That's a skill piece, absolutely. And the thing about you that people don't understand about Carrot Top or Scott is he doesn't just go to the, you know, store and buy and go, this is a crazy thing. I'm going to show the crowd this. He creates these, he invents these things. That's where the skill is involved. He combines worlds that you wouldn't want normally think to combine, and he does it visually. And then he presents it as an excellent performer. So he's got all these things coming together. And that's where I think people just assume that he's just like sort of, you know, taking shortcuts, and there's no way he does. He really has. And then if you ever see him behind the scenes, he's got a warehouse that he's got to keep track of all the props he's ever invented. So it comes down to like almost an inventory situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, but he wasn't there, I don't think, when Second City,
you know, he wasn't on one of the stages.
So he might, you know, he might have been, but he wasn't what he was now. Like, now he's like one of those staple.
Oh no, he's huge there. Yeah. Well, so one of the things I want to talk about, because one of my memories of Las Vegas. So when we landed there, and we didn't know what we were doing. Let's just all be honest. There was no research. At a certain point, someone made a deal and told me we were doing this. And I then told you, do you want to do this among this group of, I think, nine of us went out. Yeah. We got this lodging, right? This was this just off the strip. I think you could walk, right?
Meridian. Yeah. It's like a corporate condos, you could call them.
And what I loved about this, and this was actually years later, is the producer that we had when we started was our friend Robin Hammond, then Robin Johnson. And we, for the producers, we just got like this one place that had like two bedrooms, so that like when I would go there, I'd crash, so I wouldn't have to like pay for a hotel or whatever. Sure. Years later, when she moves to Chicago, my wife, I'm like, oh, this is Robin from Las Vegas, and Anne just assumed it was Robin was a guy. And as we know, of course, Robin is beautiful.
Right, she's gorgeous. She's tall, like a model, and she
yeah, she was a beauty queen, Southern beauty queen. It's like, wait a second.
That's Robin. That's not who Batman that hung out with Batman.
No, that was not. It was not Robin Gibb either. It was someone different. But then our friend Jason, who is fairly well known now, especially with his.
I think he does okay.
He's got. He might have a show on Apple TV that just concluded.
Right. Yeah. His like he was so fun to room with that Jason Sudeikis we're talking about for those who. Are coming late to the Vegas party. And what was interesting, because he was, or he still is, George Wendt, the, you know,
his nephew. Fame,
his nephew. And so that was, you know, when we first talked, he mentioned that, and I was just, I love Cheers and I loved Norm. Mm-hmm. And so I just was like, oh, well, I like this guy already, you know, and he had Jason has a confidence about him that, is sort of infectious. It's like three notches before like a jerk. And like, so, exactly. So he's like confident and funny and, but silly, like, so, mm-hmm. and the silly takes him below the sort of the, alpha jerk phase, but he's confident. But people are drawn to that. And as a performer, he was just, you know, on these Second City stages, he was one of these guys like Kakowski, where their brain has a, like an encyclopedia sort of quality to it. And they could draw anything out that they've ever heard. And they could bring it to light on stage in a moment, you know, that perfectly timed. Whereas my brain is more like a library of encyclopedia books of all the things I've ever learned. But it's been all like all the shelves have been knocked over. And so the books are piled in the middle. So I'm in there like sorting through the books, trying to find the reference that you're talking about. And I'm like, ah, it's too late now. Here it is right here. President Truman. Ah, too late. You know, so
talk about the bit he did, which is legendary in the lore of Second City road experiences, even though this was a sit down.
It was so funny. And Jason, you know, one of the things about improv is, you know, you find the game and then you play it and you heighten it. And that's sort of a key, part of that craft. And so he found a game that was incredibly funny. We at the Meridian, they would have these, I guess there would be like pieces of paper that like announcements, and they're really kind of the way they were written. It was like the most mundane things written to be the most exciting things in the world. Yes. Like, you know, an investor is coming to talk to you about your retirement. Meridian residents only, come on in and learn about the future of economics or whatever. But the way they, it was real. So he would always laugh at the presentation of these. And so he said, I'm going to start coming up with my own. So we he's my roommate and we're sitting there on the couch and we're just typing away and just coming up, just brainstorming these things. And so he takes it a whole nother level and goes to Kinko's and starts printing these things off. And so he hangs them up, these notices, amongst the other ones that are legitimate. So like you get ones like, think you can dunk on an NBA All-Star? Former National Basketball Association great Magic Johnson will be here at the Meridian to take on all comers. You know, now's your chance to see if you got what it takes. Meridian residents only, and a proper address, required. You know, things like, you know, ever thought you could wrestle an alligator? Now's your chance to find out when zookeeper blah 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 comes in. You know, in the secondary pool. You know, are you looking to be a stunt driver? Well, you know, tomorrow morning we're going to clear out the parking garage and, you know, famous racer, you know, whatever is going to come in and teach you how to spin, senior residents only. And he would just, and this just kept going on and there was one after another and each one kept getting funnier and weirder and, to the point where the person at the Meridian had to call up, you know, you guys and go, hey, listen,
they pinpointed who was responsible.
And y'all are going like, we do. We know exactly who this is.
Yeah, we know exactly who did this.
Yeah. And Jason, I mean, I'm talking like probably like 2 weeks, 3 weeks that he did this. He didn't stop. I mean, it was like, and I stopped like within about a week and a half, I got tired of it and I stopped. He was like, nope, still going. And they just kept getting funnier.
Yeah, well, that's heightening.
That's heightening.
We've had Peter McGraw on the podcast twice. You talk about, and I want to like this, his theory around benign violation theory. My wife, who just submitted her book on comedy theory to Northwestern, so it'll be published in a year, has a quibble, with him, but I want to talk to you about that because you actually bring it up, I think not in relation to that, but in the book. So can you explain what the benign violation theory as McGraw talks about it in the context of the book?
Sure. It's one of the things. It was in his TED talk, and it really changed how I began to look at the whole idea of premise, setup, and punchline. Because what the benign violation theory sort of says is laughter comes when you benignly violate an expected norm. Uh-huh. And so what a premise does is it just sort of gets the people thinking about what you want to talk about. What a setup does, what it's supposed to do is get the audience in terms of that topic to think about an expected result of whatever the story is going to be. So that's the norm that McGraw talks about. So then what he says is that in order to get a laugh, you must not only violate that norm, but you must do it benignly. And that's where I talk about where you have to heighten with these heightening devices and you have to give them something that satisfies that setup. But is unexpected. So we're talking about the same thing, but I love the way he phrases it because, well, just the term benign violation is fantastic, you know, comically. There's so many funny things happening in that. The idea that you can use the word violate and somehow think that you know, anyone is going to be okay with that. But he's like, benignly.
Yeah. But, I think that the thing is funny when Anne talks about this, she, her sort of comedy trio is pain, distance, and recognition. Yeah. So pain being another kind of sort of violation, distance being, you know, well, what can I do now that I can do later, but also can be physical and all that. And the one thing I think McGraw is missing, because you bring it up too, in the terms of callbacks, which is simple recognition.
Yeah.
There's no violation. What people sometimes simply laugh at, oh, I've seen that thing, which is sometimes a character who is in the first act shows up in the background of the second act. And there is one of those things of like, oh, and I think this is actually a pretty, I haven't seen other people talk about this because I think it is very unique and interesting. And there's probably more playing there, which is why simply because we recognize something, are we laughing at it? It's not all the time. But it is often that all you have to do is stick, like, and Mick Napier, who was your director and worked with me a lot, was a master of this, of like just popping something in the show later that appeared in the first act. And you're like, oh my God, that thing got a laugh.
Yeah. It's really curious, isn't it? The recognition is a heightening device, and it's the ability to take something that people like a common, it could be a visual, it could be a word, it could be a phrase, it could be a way that we term something, but it's something that's in a sort of the pot of what we all know about, and you pull that in there, but it's got to be in the right place though. That it's got to really it's got to be a thing that satisfies that setup in a way that you weren't expecting, but then there's another level to it where you go, and I know what that thing is. I know what 4 billion hamburgers sold is. I know that that's the McDonald's sign. So I get the extra laugh from that.
Yeah.
But I think there's all like some, I mean, you can't, like Mick has proved many times, you just have to throw it out there sometimes and it will get the laugh. But I think it goes a little bit more complicated than that because of, you know, the wiring in your head. And
no, 100%. Well, that's the math part of it.
It really is it, right?
This is the interesting thing because, okay, so to be successful in comedy, I think this is true in all the different forms. There's that understanding of sort of the social, cultural, human aspect and math. And normally a bunch of us were never good at one or the other. And so when you find the people who kind of like, and this is the thing that always amazed me with Matt, with Mick, is he's a math nerd. So he had both that lived experience of weirdo outsider,
right?
Both of us, with this idea of, oh no, I get what this equation might look like. And so I can play like a mixing board. Anne often uses that sort of example. And it's really kind of a stunning feat. And I think what you say in your book, which is all that stuff can be learned and you give examples. And then, but the real hard thing, and this is what everyone has to do, is just do it over and over and over again. And that's hard.
Well, and so is learning, you know, three chords on a guitar, and so is,
and then doing it over to get your calluses,
a tennis ball over a net, and then beginning to play an actual game. So, you know, but you can practice these things and get them more into your muscle memory if you know what to practice. And that's what I'm trying to do with my book. Yeah. I'm trying to give not just professional comedians, but also people who are just want to be funnier, something that they can actually practice. And to apply these heightening devices over and over again is that practice that I mentioned. And my second book that I'm about to finish now is Fine Tuning Your Funny Muscle, which sort of goes into more detail, all 36 of those heightening devices, gives more details and examples, and then also takes a comedy bit from the very beginning and heightens it 36 different times using each of those devices to show you how that works on a new idea.
It's interesting. So something that you're doing with this book that I have not seen in a lot of the, and I've read so many of these, of the various comedy books, is in the same way that you get a book, if you're a beginning guitar player, with here's a series of scales, here's a series of scales. You just have to do them over and over again. And then you'll get the like Beatles, whatever book to figure out that, but it's meaningless without the other. A lot of the comedy books, and I think because comedians want to show off how smart they are, forget that other part was the thing that they all did.
Yeah. And it seems basic, but if you don't know what to practice, it's very frustrating. And the thing about my book is the first thing you do is you figure out what's your lens. And one of the things that's frustrating about being funny is if you don't have a lens, you literally could go any direction. So, you know, I used to sit, that's when the ceiling I hit, where I was like, I need new material fast. What's funny? Spray bottle on my desk, a glass of water. What's funny about a headset? You know, I would just go around and look at the world and go, I don't know how to look at it. But now with a lens, I'm the clumsy aspiehole. So now everything I look at, I'm looking at it through that lens so that it has an element of that to start out with. So it's about how in this, what am I noticing and what am I notifying people like with unsolicited information? What am I noticing that's not correct? And I'm feeling that the need to correct it, you know, as a dad or as a person who's in a marriage or as a person who's walking down the street and interacting with other people. And it begins to really narrow down, in a good way, my take on why things are funny. And then it doesn't limit you as you might think, because what it does is it focuses you, and focusing doesn't limit you, because you can apply this lens to anything and everything. But what it does is it gives you that first step. You go, oh, this, you know, and every single, you know, like Jerry Seinfeld, when he goes to look at something new, he looks for the thing that most people overlook, and he tries to make a big deal out of it. And then he does it in different and clever ways. And the better he gets at his own lens, the less you can see it on the surface of what he's doing.
Well, one of the things that people miss all the time is creativity desires constraints.
Yeah.
If you've just got this giant, you know, nothing, you know, it's like there's nothing interesting that's going to happen. So you have a stage that is a very specific size. Mm-hmm. You have a kind of audience in front of you that's a very specific audience. And what I think, you know, because you toured, so you understudied and you did all those things, it's like the college gig compared to Las Vegas, compared to Chicago, wildly different. And you, if you're going to be successful, have to figure out how you make that slight adjustment without losing the thing that makes you funny. Jesus, hold on, sorry.
I keep forgetting that you're also running a dental office there where you record.
Oh my God, this guy. Well, this is here. I'm leaving this in. We're almost done, but this is what we discovered, that none of our alarm systems worked, and I'm only saying this now. There you go. This is classic comedy. Hold on one second, Mike. Okay. He said he's done drilling.
God.
Yeah. All our alarm systems, none of them worked. This guy walked in today with like boxes of like, oh yeah, they all need to be replaced. I'm like, all right, good to know. Good to know. That anyone could have broken in here at any given time and taken all the jewels that we
have. All that works is a sign in your front yard. That's the thing. That's the real alarm system.
We should have thought of that. We really should have thought of that. So I'm curious too, in terms of, you did this very interesting swing that, not quite frankly, is so much more representative of 1960s Second City, when you had David Steinberg, Robert Klein, Joan Rivers work here, who were all became very important stand-up comedians. That did not exist after that period. and only sort of, I think TJ would be one who came in, TJ Miller, and you're another. So I'm just sort of curious, out of all that experience, what did you take away? And it can be positive and negative. I mean, I think that there's probably elements of both in terms of that, because you had a national stand-up career. You were on The Tonight Show, and that is a different world than what it is to do the Second City stuff.
Well, the first thing I would say is I took a massive pay cut.
Yeah, that's true.
That was the first thing I noticed.
Dinner,
I like,
no.
Oh my God, I feel like now I know what teachers feel like. You know, where you have a valuable skill and no one wants to pay you for it. And we were happy to do it because, you know, when you're getting stage time as an improviser, it's just gold. And when you're getting in front of a paid crowd, it's even richer. And so that was the first thing I noticed, that I had to really turn that part off. I had to say, you know, because I was still gigging, so I could finance my career, you know, my bills and stuff by you know, farming out some stand up stuff. But my style of stand up was so conducive to an improvising world that I had to make the crossover. I had to learn to do better the things that I was doing organically as a stand-up, which was a lot of these act outs. And one of the things I realized in terms of my performance, I'm an enchanter. I'm sort of an anthropomorphizer. I'm somebody who can look at something and give you the other voices and other angles of what you would say, where you're zooming out and looking at all the different ways that you, which is really like a kind of cognitive empathy, mm-hmm. really forcing yourself to begin to see what are other people dealing with in this situation. And my comedy was always, part of that. It was always like, here's the joke and then here's the act. In fact, I remember the bit. Do you remember the bit when you were, deciding whether or not I was going to be part of the touring company? Mm-hmm. You had me do some stand up, or maybe it was just to get into the program.
I think it was touring company.
Yeah. And I remember you said, you know, oh, I hear you do some stand up. Why don't you do some? Mm-hmm. Which always makes me laugh, because I'm like, oh man, I'm not good at just like, oh, now, and here is my stand up.
But I did
that bit about living with a woman. And I said, I don't know if you remember it, but I said, you know, when you live with someone, it's so much harder to break up with them, you know, especially if you have a lot of stuff. You know, because then I did the whole act out where it was like, you know, it's not working out. I'm getting my dishes and plates. I'm getting my this sofa bed. And look, we can work this out. You know, and it was funny because I didn't have much after that, and I was afraid you were going to make me do more time. But then you cut me off. I got good laugh. I got a little bit of an applause break. And then you were like, okay, that's great. And it showed you that my stand up wasn't, I'm not a one liner guy. In fact, I was very much missing the written part. That was what I realized was my big thing. I was going from premise to punchline, and I was forgetting about the setup step. And that's part of the craft of doing stand up that you must have in there, because otherwise I say it's just like a speech, you know, like you're trying to do a funny speech, and the craft of getting people to misdirect. That's part of the flex of getting a laugh. And when you don't have that, that's what a lot of new comedians don't understand. And that's what this book goes over. My book breaks that down, so you begin to understand, oh, I'm missing a step here. I got to set them up and get them thinking of something normal. And then so I can, as Peter McGraw says, benignly violate that with a heightened punchline. So, now I forgot what I was answering, which question.
Oh, you're already doing it. It's this, like, what'd you take from here? What did you not take from here? But yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so with the improv, this is like one of the things that I was always really good at as a stand up was dealing with hecklers. Yeah. And the reason why I was always good with hecklers is because I didn't go tit for tat. I'm not very good. I'm not like a roast comic. I'm not a guy who can, you know, respond and cut you down the way you just cut me down or try to, you know, in front of my audience. So what I was always good at is I was a good listener, and I could listen. And to me, that's what, you know, your podcast is about yes anding, which is just a brilliant, brilliant concept, in general. That's what I teach my kids, because what yes anding involves, it's not just agreement, which there's a general sense of agreement, and there's also a higher level of agreement where you can disagree, but you're agreeing with a bigger thing.
Yeah.
But what yes anding also involves is listening. You got to listen to different levels of what the person was saying. And that's what I was realizing a lot of stand-up comics weren't doing. They would, when you go tit for tat, you're listening to what they say and you're responding to what they say. Now, what I would do with hecklers, I would listen to why they said it, how they said it, when did they say it in the show? Where were they sitting when they said it? And where was I in my act when they said it? What did they not say while they were doing the thing? And I would take all those things and I would listen and make conclusions and do what I think we were talking about before with Mick, was a connecting world, like the mathematical part. That's what comedy is connecting unlikely worlds and finding those connections. And that's what seems mathematical about it and what Mick is so brilliant at. He can find two separate things and find the one thing that's common about those two worlds and bring those together. So now all of a sudden, you know, frog isn't funny and bank isn't funny, but he figures out a way to create a frog bank, and then they're depositing flies and they're doing all these combined worlds. And that's the mathematics of the heightening game that really, I fell in love with improv. And so by taking classes and being trained by the best at Second City, and also I was over at IO Theater what's the other one?
Annoyance.
Annoyance. Sorry for forgetting that. They're brilliant with Susan Messing in that gang. And I loved what it did for my stand up, because what it began to do is it began to give me a better idea of how to do those act outs, how to begin to see the bigger picture of what it is I was presenting. And so for me, there was no problem between those two worlds. But what I began to realize very quickly is you can't go for a laugh in improv. You just can't try to be funny. You have to almost try to be serious. And through that, the humor comes out. And you've watched anyone who's Neil Flynn, Dave Koechner, they're never trying to be funny. They're trying to be as serious as they can about this dang thing. And why are people keep laughing during my serious attempt at this? And that's what's funny. And the second they try, laughter leaves.
Yeah. Fascinating. All right. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. I'm assuming you have one for us.
Sure. I've thought a lot about this, and there's so many parts of my life that were a key yes and moment. But what I have to trace it back to, like the original yes and that brought all of this other stuff forth, was I went to college to learn management information systems, and I minored in computer science and graduated with honors. And I worked for 2 years in a corporate environment with AT&T. And so I was a programmer with AT&T.
I did not know any of this.
I was making a fat five-figure salary.
Oh, dude.
You know, with bonus. And but I was the guy who, like, you know, picture a cubicle, like say you're zooming out and you're my boss and you're like, you know, 100 yards away. All you see is a line of cubicles. And then you see one cubicle that has like six people's heads over it, all laughing. Mm-hmm. And I'm in that cubicle and I'm working, I'm doing my job, I'm getting done the program I need to get done while entertaining these people who happen to be passing by, and I could just pop, 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 pop. And he finally called me in and he was like, Mike, you're doing a great job, but why are you here? What are you doing?
I love this guy.
Right. And he wasn't being a jerk. He was my friend. He was like, why are you here? This doesn't seem like you seem capable of doing so much more. And almost like run, little bird, but be free. Yeah. Get out of the nest before it traps you with the golden handcuffs or the golden claw cuffs or whatever a bird has. And, so my big yes and was when my mom cut an article out that said Disney MGM Studios is auditioning for comic actors. And I had been taking an acting class at the time, you know, just to do anything creative, you know, and I was in a band. And so I played keyboards, Cellophane Rain, if you're wondering what the name of the band was, very hipster, 80s band. And I went to my acting coach and I said, should I do this? And he's like, listen, if you don't, you're going to regret it for the rest of your life. I go, but this is kind of complicated. This audition is up in Cleveland and we live in Cincinnati. So and I have to work on these. It's on a Thursday. And so I'm going to have to like call in sick. And he's like, do it. And so the audition was a minute. So we worked on like what happens in a minute. What could I do that would be fun and funny in a minute? So I was like, well, an elevator ride lasts a minute. Mm-hmm. And in Cleveland, they have the Terminal Tower, which is at the very top, has a very luxurious restaurant. So I said, I'm going to do the Luxurivator, and it's going to be two characters. The first one is going to be the control panel engineer who welcomes people in. He's a very old gentleman who's mm-hmm. been there forever, and he operates the control, and he's no monkey business with this guy.
Right.
And then the other character is a guy who's the lounge singer. And then I spun around and pulled out a microphone out of my back pocket and began to sing such hits as "When We Get Behind Closed Doors" and other elevator pun mm-hmm. things. But the whole thing lasted like less than a minute. So that was what the funny part was. It was like right in the middle of my act, I'm like, "Whoop, there we are, you're here." And then, you know, and then so it killed. Like these Disney people hadn't seen anything like this, and all that, you know, people were doing, you know, Sound of Music monologues and stuff. And I did this thing and they were like, "What is this?" So they called me back. So I had to yes and again, and I had to call in sick a second time from mm-hmm. Cleveland to Cincinnati. Luckily, this was in the 80s when there was no caller ID or anything. You know,
right. So they couldn't tell you where.
They couldn't. And this was AT&T. This is the phone company that I'm calling. Yeah. So, you know, if they can't tell, nobody can. So then I did the second audition. I got videotaped, which is what all the people who looked like they were going to get the job. And I ended up getting the gig. So the big yes and that I would tell you is I gave up a corporate computer programming job for a corporate entertainment job with Disney MGM Studios, where I had to move everything I had down to Florida and begin a new life as an entertainer. And that's when I began to yes and stand-up comedy, because I took that workshop. That's when I yes and a second job at Universal Studios after I was got a raise and a bigger job with this secondary studio. And then I yes-anded the idea of going into the world of stand-up based on that. So the one yes-and triggered all these other yes-ands. And I could trace it back to everything I've ever done. That first idea of saying, okay, this situation comes up. How do I not only agree with it and embrace it, but also heighten it to a new level? And that's, to me, is the key to yes anding, is to really listen in on what it is you're talking about and what it is you're being offered, or what it is you're considering, or what it is that someone else is throwing out there, and then zoom out and see all the angles of it and really accept that that's true. Even if, you know, if someone says, "I'm your mom," well, you can say, you know, "Yeah, my fake mom, because, you know, I'm adopted." That's not negating it. That's yes anding. I'm agreeing that you play a mother role. So there's ways to do that. So to me, the original yes and I did by quitting that corporate job led to all the other risks taking that I did. And it wasn't risky though, because I realized it's simply saying yes to life and saying, I have the guts and I think the skills to pull this off. And so, and that boy, that to being a husband, to being a father, mm-hmm. like you have to, there's a tremendous amount of faith and trust you have to have in yourself to do any of that. So yes anding started with that really tough one, which is giving up that fat check.
I love it. The book is called Finding Your Funny Muscle: How to Create Laughs Like a Pro. Mike Lucas, thanks for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much, Kelly.